We're going to actually open up to you guys in just 1 minute, but we just want to sort of wrap up really with a quick thought from each of the guys, well, Charlie in particular, just about the progress since 20 years.
Okay, can I just say two things? First of all, I agree what Eamon's after saying. In 2009, one of my last reporting jobs for RTE was to go into Gaza. And the bombing had happened. It's like a mirror image today, except the numbers who've been killed in the Palestinian side is even greater. But the events, the shellings, the hospitals, I was brought around in 2009 as it was coming to an end. I look today, and I started off as a young kid, you know, and I joined the Irish Times as a library assistant in 1974. I was there the day of the Dublin and Monaghan bombings. My first job in RTE as a researcher was to go into the murder triangle. And, you know, at least from the south, I can say it. I can drive up here today. I can go to Derry. I can walk across, you know, the Foyle Peace Bridge. And things, from my perspective, have really, really, really moved on. And that is absolutely fantastic as far as I'm concerned. And there's two brief anecdotes because they tell something for me. In 1997, when the ceasefire was reintroduced, there are comical situations. I was to meet my contact, Patrick, at 8:30 in the morning. On this occasion, I was the only one getting this statement. It was choreographed. Bertie Ahern had just been elected. Mm. Tony Blair had just been elected. I was to go to the Fairways Hotel to be there at 8:30 in the morning to meet my contact. I drove into the Fairways Hotel. Patrick was there in his car. But two cars down from him was a Garda car. Now, it was a traffic car. It had nothing to do with anything. It wasn't sinister. But he still said no. Get into my car. We drove down the road about 500 yards. He drove into a car wash. He handed me the piece of paper, which he wouldn't. He said, "You're not taking that with you, but you're to write it out in longhand." So I started to scribble it out longhand. After about 2 minutes, he got back into the car, put down the bonnet, and he said, "Read it back to me." So I read it back to him, and I said, "You know, statement from the IRA." He said, "Stop. No." I said, "What's wrong?" He said, this is a real rush. He said, "Oglina Heron." I was to write Oglina Heron, and he would not, I'm telling you as I sit here, he would not, IRA had to be scraped out, and I had to write Oglina Heron on it. It never got on the 9 o'clock news. They had to change the broadcasting. It got out 10 or 15 minutes later. Forward to 2005, for me, the last time I was here in Belfast, the Culturalin, the day the IRA disbanded. 20 years ago, I was given a small cassette. On this occasion, they gave a DVD. Mm. A DVD. I was brought to a house not far from here, unaware. And my contact put the DVD into the machine, and it wouldn't play. It was to be out at 11 o'clock in the morning. We took it out, went like that, and put it in again, and it played. Yeah. And you know the person who read the statement?
He's here.
Stand up. I actually saw him. But to me, it was worth it. And as I was walking out the door, I said to the contact, who was Tomás, I said to him, "You know, what are you going to do at 4 o'clock this evening when it happens?" And he said to me, "I'm just going to do what I normally do." But that was my journey over 12 years, meeting four people, and it was remarkable. Mm. And but the only point I want to make is that for all of us, we've got to continue, as Eamon says, to make it work. Because we have something very precious now, which they don't have in Gaza, and I don't believe they're going to have it for a long, long time. But what we have here, all of us, collectively on this island, and whatever about being a postman, I lived through a piece of history, and I was privileged to live through it.
Well done. I noticed Gary Mason sitting up the back of the hall here, and you know, when you look at people's faces, you remember certain things. And I remember standing with Gary at the bedside of David Irvine in January 2007, when they just switched the machine off. And Gary had asked a few people to join hands around the bed to say a final prayer, and David Irvine and I had become good mates. Some people thought that's strange, you know, a journalist and a politician, but we were close enough to each other to be able to say whatever needed to be said. So there was probably a greater honesty in the relationship. And I remember being called on the Sunday by David's son to say that he'd had the heart attack, the stroke, that he was in the Ulster Hospital, that they were moving under the Royal. And January 2007 was when we were at the point of the DUP considering whether or not they should do business with Sinn Féin and go into government. And there was a saying around at that time, "Not in my political lifetime," from a few people. And I remember saying to Gary in the corridor of the Royal, "How long is a political lifetime?" Because I'd spoken to David Irvine on the Saturday night when he was full of life. He'd been to a football match. The Glens had beaten Armagh 8-0. He'd been down to the Raven for a few pints. He had written an article which he wanted published in the Belfast Telegraph. I'd sorted that out, that it was going to be published. There were a few spelling mistakes in it. He had spelled Ardèche incorrectly. He had asked my son how you spell it correctly, and it was even worse after after that attempt. And Davy had said to me on Saturday night, I'll tidy this up and I'll send it through to you on Sunday at lunchtime. And when the phone went on Sunday at lunchtime, I thought it was him. I said, "Hiya, David." And it was his son, Mark, to tell me this news. And Val, my wife, when we got to the Royal, they just switched off the machine. But basically what David Irvine was doing in that article was encouraging Paisley to take the next steps. And he told me a story just a few weeks previously. He said that Adams had called him, David Irvine. Adams had called David Irvine. He says, "I'm thinking of saying something, addressing the unionist Protestant community. What should I say?" And Irvine says, "They ask Paisley, is his war over?" And, you know, I think Adams was probably expecting something that was, you know, he was going to say to try to persuade the unionist community. And that was Irvine's line. "Ask Paisley, is his war over?" And, you know, I think about where we are now and where we were in that period. I think Irvine brought a particular leadership to that community. A leadership which allowed him on occasions to sit down with McGuinness and Adams and Gerry Kelly and work things through to a sensible conclusion. And I think 7 years on, he is still badly missed within this process. I think loyalism gets angry about this. I think their contribution to the peace process is not properly acknowledged. I think in that period, particularly 94 to 98, they were heading in the right direction. They were at the centre of things, and they had people who I think brought a new language, a new way to things. I mean, I can remember the first interviews with Irvine and Davy Adams and Gary McMichael, and people wondered what cupboards they'd been locked up in for 10 or 15 years. But all of a sudden, loyalism was going to speak for itself. But I just, when I see Gary there, I think about that line about how long is a political lifetime, Gary. You know, because it can end tomorrow. It can end for all of us tomorrow. And I think our responsibility, the journalistic responsibility, is not to blow trumpets for the peace process. That's not our role. But our role is to report the peace process with as much energy as we reported the conflict. And I wonder why on occasions like this there is not a greater media interest. This to me is as important as some of those big headlines in the conflict period, because we see people in rooms now that we wouldn't have seen them in 10 or 15 years ago. And we shouldn't take for granted what we have. And I think that's the greatest danger that still remains, that people think the peace is secure. The peace still needs to be built.
Could I just make an observation? I don't know if any of you saw a few programmes in which I was involved there with Ian Paisley. but
is that on the Comedy Channel?
But Ian Paisley's son, Kyle, made an interesting observation. He said, once the IRA put away their instruments of death, and given the level of support for republicanism, it would be unchristian not to accept them in government. And I think that was part, given the IRA ceasefire, given what Ian Paisley did ultimately, I think that was the political miracle of Northern Ireland. I think we have lived through a political miracle in Northern Ireland, and we're still living through it. There are serious deficits. Today, Peter Robinson said, I think he was in Scotland on duty in his capacity as First Minister, arising out of the memorials for the Hundred Years' War. He said, remembrance and reconciliation are relevant in Northern Ireland as we continue to build a peaceful and shared society. Despite the fact that I think we have lived through a political miracle, given where we are, and with due respect to the silence of the guns on all sides, generally speaking, within loyalism and in republicanism, we have to ask ourselves, though, is that a true statement? Is it being put into effect that remembrance and reconciliation are contributing or are being implemented to realise a shared society? That's where we're at. We're not putting this into practice to bring about a shared society. There are such deficits here. We are still so far apart from a shared society. And that is the real challenge facing us all now, Judith.
We did give you a 5 minutes heads up, and I know there are questions out there.
25 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. It's a bit longer than anticipated. So, yeah, panel is free to take questions. So, yep.
I'd like to ask the panel a few questions, if you don't mind. First of all, thank you so much for that very forensic historical statements, etc.
That's good. You identify made. My
statement is this. We all basically know what's happened here from about 1920 onwards, more or less. Yeah? So I'm going to put this on the spot. I suppose the answer to this question is, I don't know, but I'm going to ask you anyway. What do you think is going to happen here?
Can I just ask you to just tell us your name?
John.
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 John who? Eamon wants to know.
I'm not Iron Peter.
Peter would not, yeah.
I don't know what's going to happen is the honest answer to your question. I think politically we're on very shaky ground. I wrote recently that we don't have partnership government. I think in some respects politically we're going backwards. I'm wondering for how much longer that's credible, sustainable. When people have to make a judgment as to whether it's untenable. So I think there is, and I'm not directing this towards one side of the community. Eamon asked a moment ago, do we have a shared future? Do we have shared space? What is remembering and commemoration contributing to the peace? I think when all people remember, they also send out reminders of where we were and what happened. There is the, I think, in the absence of a process that addresses the past in some way, whatever that way eventually becomes, I think in the absence of that process, we're still hurting people. And I'm not just talking about one side of the community, I'm talking about all sides of the community, and we're being hurt by all sorts of reminders of what happened. I've said this and I've written about this. I think if we come out of this conflict blaming only those who went to jail, then we'll not have addressed the past. We'll have run the brush across part of the Republican and Loyalist community, and we'll have allowed many people to exit the stage without any sense of responsibility. So we have these battles about the past. I wonder, is the past about answering people's questions, or is the past still about trying to win and lose? Is the past about I was right and you were wrong? And I just want to use this one little example. It's a loyalist example, but it is one of those moments that has stayed with me throughout the 30 plus years that I've reported in this place. Mm-hmm. It was an interview I did in 1998 with a loyalist who had served a life sentence. And the battle at that stage was between prisoner release and the rights of victims. And in the course of this interview, this man said to me, "We sleep with the victims." And I knew exactly what he meant, but I asked him to explain. And basically, he couldn't sleep with what he'd done. And I remember saying to someone afterwards, "That man needs help." And several months later, he was found hanging in his home. Now, to me, that man is a victim of this conflict. That's not to condone what he did, but it is to I think, try to stretch the narrative and the argument away from right and wrong and good and bad and that very narrow frame in which some people want to discuss the past. I think journalistically, in the period we were reporting the conflict, we went from one killing to the next. So we were reporting on the facts of, or not the facts, just the detail of the actual incident. I think when you come out of a conflict situation, when you come out of reporting a conflict situation, there is more time to properly reflect on what happened. And there is nothing that would shock me now. This conflict became, to use Irvine's words, a stinking little war. And it wasn't just about Republicans and Loyalists. So politically, I think we're on not good ground. I'm not sure that we will ever have the past properly addressed. I think we should stop calling it a truth process, because none of the sides, never mind all the sides, will produce what people believe is truth. I think we need some sort of table of explanation, and I think we need everyone at that table. And when I say everyone, I mean from governments, from politicians, to Republicans and Loyalists, to the spooks, to the security forces, to us as journalists. And I don't mean us there asking the questions, I mean us there answering some of the questions as well. Because I think we need to reflect on not only what we did, but what we didn't do in terms of our reporting of the events. Do I think we're out of the woods and we're in a safe place? No, I don't. But where it's going to go, John, I have no idea.
Okay, leading up their side.
My name is Rosie Lawler. I just want to reflect on what Jim Gilney said earlier on. I too went to the graveyard. I went to the graveyard to the grave of my brother, who was an IRA volunteer, murdered by a Brit, a faceless Brit, in 1971 during the massacre of Ballymurphy. He was at the end of it. I also looked at the graves around of his comrades, and I remember looking at his grave and seeing his age, and I remember saying, "Eamon, we've got a ceasefire, and I hope that we get peace with justice, and I hope you didn't die in vain, and all your comrades." But just to say that I fully support, and my family fully support, the peace process. And I agree with you, it's not a truth process, it's a peace process. And the path's not straight, you know? Mm. And we get, and there's times I feel, oh God, another brick wall. But I fully believe in it. And I fully believe that my brother did not die in vain.
Thank you. Time for one more question.
Column C.
Oh, right at the back, yeah.
My name is Colin Dorr. Point was saying there that we need to find ways of dealing with the past that aren't simply ways of regenerating the conflict in terms of you were wrong and you were right. And it seems to me Republicans have already accepted that and are prepared to say unionists, you know, we have narratives that we may not agree on. And it seems to me to be a particularly unionist thing to insist on this black and white narrative. Obviously, I'm troubled with the IRA as well. Not accepting anything for unionism for the state, and I think that puts into particularly sharp relief the loss of David Irvine, as you say. Anything unionism seems to go backwards. Mike Hesbitt described it as shrinking through. I think what he meant was regressing to growth, and I think that he is particularly culpable because he knows better than some of his peers that he's allowing to be lived up, and he made a particular choice that he wasn't going to follow the modernizers like McAllister. As I say, chose the path of regressing. So I just wonder, in the absence of David Irvine, and the way that unionism seems to be regressing, just wonder, what do you think can be done to encourage unionism to not regress and to be more progressive? Because the Progressive Unions Party is now progressive in the end. So do we just simply have to wait for another year?
John, McCallum, John, Donald,
is there anything we can do to
on that river, John Donald?
Okay, Colin, yeah.
Yeah.
John, did you have something you wanted to ask? Or are you just leaning forward for a particular reason?
My name is John Dunlop. I came here not knowing that I'd be out of.
You love it, John. You love it.
Let me say that I was engaged in some conversation with Sinn Féin over a good number of years. I find it quite a scary experience often because I assumed when people I was talking to were either very close to the IRA or members of the IRA. And they were killing a lot of people, and I was burying some of them. My argument with them, as I've stated in public, was that their political analysis was wrong, that their problem was not London and the Brits, but I was their problem. Therefore, they had to make peace with me in the community that I was a part of.
You were the British presence, John, is what you meant?
I was a part of it.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I wouldn't describe myself in those terms. Because that would be to misunderstand what I'm talking about.
Right, okay.
All right. Okay. But those were serious conversations because to put that challenge to Sinn Féin is a very, very serious challenge. You mentioned Roy McGee. Roy McGee was an extraordinarily courageous senior colleague of mine who did things with the UVF. You talk about being taken in cars with dark glasses by persons unknown to locations unknown. That Roy had a lot of that. I didn't have any of that. I think there's a difference between a reporter and a journalist. My question is a journalist question to a journalist. Why did the IRA call the ceasefire? What was the thinking which lay behind the decision?
That's next year's talk.
John, could I invite somebody who might know the answer to that? Who might be in this room?
Are you going to have a stab at it? Or?
I don't know.
Let me say this. I was constantly dependent upon journalists to keep me informed as to what was going on. Because I was never too sure I was actually being told the truth. Because there are layers of duplicity in this which are incredibly complex. So you guys really have a responsibility to call it like it was insofar as you understand it.
Well, I would say, John, that there's more than a grain of truth in what you've just said yourself. You are of the side of this place. And I can't speak for the IRA, but I suspect ultimately the IRA realized they had to reconcile with you and people like you. And when you consider your own engagement and the engagement of Ken Newell, also a Presbyterian minister, who journeyed, in his own words, who journeyed into the hearts of members of the IRA in Clonard, and who got to know and spoke the same language as yourself, he was going to them, talking to them as people involved in a killing campaign, at the same time as he was burying members of his congregation. And I recall the night of the big discussion in Conwy Mill about the transition within republicanism and the move towards acceptance of the police here, policing here. And John stood up. It was a very telling moment. Oh, sorry, Ken Yule stood up, the Reverend Ken Yule stood up. And he said, "My dad," he said, "was a B special. Does anyone here think that I thought my dad was a bad man?" For me, that was one of the most profound statements of what we are. My dad could have been a B special too. Any Republican's dad could have been in a different set of circumstances. So I think there's a realization, but I can't speak for how the IRA thought. I'm trying to interpret, ultimately.
Yeah.
But it was something that Hume promoted very heavily about uniting of people, not territory. It was a big Hume philosophy from way, way back. He held to that view, the importance of uniting people as opposed to uniting land. So there are people who are better qualified to speak about why the IRA did what they did ultimately.
John, I think, and this again is from memory, and Danny will clarify. You'll remember Peter Brook made the statement that it was difficult, and some senior military people made this statement, I think around 89, 90, somewhere in around there, that it was difficult to envisage a military defeat of the IRA. And I can remember some people around the Republican side saying at that time that once Brooke made that statement, there was a moral responsibility on the Republican part to then consider the question, could they achieve a military defeat against the British? And I think that's the point in all of this, where there is the acceptance of a stalemate. The IRA had been armed by Libya, obviously. They could have continued the campaign for a considerable period of time thereafter. But for what purpose? And I think once you get into a peace process, then momentum is the key ingredient. Because when it's moving, people move also. And I think that's the danger of, jogging on the spot or jogging backwards. I think at the time, I described the IRA ceasefire as the political equivalent of the cow actually jumping over the moon. Because, to answer your question, if you'd have taken everything that Republicans had said up to that point, a unilateral secession was not on the cards. Martin McGuinness did an interview with me in Easter 1994 where he said the British were still attempting to achieve a victory over Republicans. That's how suspicious Republicans were. But I think somewhere in that period of the early 90s, there was that realization. And it started with that Brooke statement, and then in the repeated statements of senior military figures at that stage, difficult to envisage a military defeat of the IRA. And then I think the IRA then, despite the fact that their bunkers were stuffed with Libyan weapons, had to consider, can we really defeat the Brits? To use that language. And I think once you got into that process, once you got the loyalists involved, once you began to get sort of demilitarization alongside arms beyond use, then all things become possible. But you can't at some stage then just stop. And to go back to John's question, I think we've stopped and we're jogging on the spot, and in some cases we're going backwards because we don't know what the next steps are going to be.
And it would appear to me, as an observer, unless Dublin and London become directly involved, unless we go back to those hothouse discussions in Hillsborough Castle involving David Cameron and Enda Kenny or their equivalents, I don't think we're going to resolve this. We're incapable. We're incapable of policing ourselves in so many areas. I think we're going to have to involve these guys again if we're going to get a resolution and to dig ourselves out of the impasse in which we find ourselves right this moment in time.
I find it difficult as a journalist, because normally I'm involved in reporting something, but I'm going to say something now because I'm no longer working for RTE. Sometimes when you live through history, you don't see it.
Mm.
Sometimes when you're living through history, you don't see it. John asked the question, what's going to happen in the future? Well, again, I say, if somebody had said to me, even 5 years ago, Sinn Féin's going to be on 24% of the vote in the South, I would have said, you're mad. Now, up here, and Barney says, you know, you're treading water, you're time. From my perspective, I look at it at the positive rather than the negative. And the reason why, I look at somebody like Nelson Mandela, and I know South Africa is also in the same position. The difficulties are there. But I think if people have left strengths, towers there, that you can build upon them. And I think that is still happening. I don't live up here, so it's easy for me to say it in the comfort. And even as a journalist all the time, you know, it was always difficult to come up here because I wasn't close to what was happening, the daily killings. And the people in this room, the people all over this city went through it. And it was easy for a journalist from the South to say it. But I would still say it today. I still say it. Having walked down to the Titanic Centre today, to see the number of Dublin cars, Wicklow cars, cars from all over the South, piling into it. Don't be blinkered. To go to the Peace Bridge in Derry, about 6 or 7 months ago, it was fantastic. It was absolutely fantastic. And I believe that despite all the difficulties, despite what Barney's saying, I understand. And I know it may be a glib comment, but I do believe that you're going to succeed. We're going to come out of this. It's going to, and there will be turns, there will be twists. There'll be more bad days. But I don't think we're going back.
Oh, no.
I genuinely do not believe that we are going back in this country.
Yeah.
In Gaza, yes. In other parts of the world. Do you know, I spent a number of years in America as the Washington correspondent. I also was sort of controversial. I think it was 18 or 19 months. Whatever you think about Barack Obama, whatever you think about, I'm not his politics, but the idea that a black man was elected president of the United States and was sitting in the White House, that a black person, and that he was elected a second time. Things can happen in this world. Mm. They can happen. I'm not asking you to believe what you think about Barack Obama, whether he's a great guy or a bad guy, but the idea that a black man, after everything that happened in the United States, was elected twice into the White House, I do believe that it's going to succeed. It will be difficult, it will be really difficult, but I do believe it's going to succeed.
Just to pick up on what Charlie said there, I just want to make clear, I don't think, and I'm on exactly the same page as you, Charlie, I don't think we're going back to where we were. The damage that I'm concerned about, John, is politically. I think Trimble wanted this to work.
So do I.
I think Robinson wants this to work. Okay? I believe Paisley wanted it to work. And I think that asks of Republicans, and I know some people might think this is outrageous, it asks them to think, is there another step we can take? Republicans are in a very strong position, politically north and south at this stage. Unionism is feeling vulnerable. And I think there are occasions such as the period we're in where Republicans still need to think about what they're doing and about what they could do to convince senior unionists and loyalists that they are genuinely serious about a peace process, about a shared future and about shared space. I think that's a challenge for Republicans and I don't think they should shirk it.
Well, I think you should be more specific. Are you talking about the Republicans should agree to welfare cuts or should agree to people walking up?
I'm not talking about welfare.
I don't understand the magnitude of the gesture you're asking.
I'm not talking about welfare cuts, okay? But within the unionist and loyalist community, there is still a view that all Republicans are interested in is winning. And I think they need to convince some people in the unionist community that in terms of this peace process, it is about a shared future, it is about shared space, it's about how you work that out and how it is done. But it is not sitting back and saying, we've got a huge vote in the South, we're doing all right up here, and we'll jog along on that happy route. There are people within the Protestant, Unionist, Loyalist community that still need to be convinced that Republicans are genuinely interested in peace and genuinely interested in sharing this space with them. I know you're shaking your head, Leslie, but they are. And I know in the Republican community, there are people who think these guys aren't serious at all.
Well, I think after 20 years, it's been the Republican community primarily that has made concessions and compromised. And I think at this point, there are a lot of people waiting to see some concessions and compromise from the unionists and the loyalist community.
And I understand that in the Republican community.
It seems within this community that it's always the Republican community that has to give and give and give.
And
it is not reciprocated.
Well, I would say, when you say it's not reciprocated, Leslie, we're in a much better place than we were.
I'm not disputing
that. No, absolutely.
I'm not disputing that. But I'd be very interested in knowing specifically what you think the Republican community could do at this point to convince unionists and loyalists that they are serious about peace. I think they have proven that over the last 20 years and continue to do so.
Leslie, I am not saying that Republicans are not serious about peace. But there are people who still need to be persuaded. And of course Republicans need to be persuaded that unionists are serious about this process as well. But what I've seen in the last year is people talking at each other rather than talking to each other. That is no way to sort this out. And I think there is going to be a moment in this process where people pull at the wrong thread and the whole thing could unravel politically. And I think that's what people need to try to avoid. So what I'm saying is there needs to be a conversation, Leslie. It's not about what more you can give, what more concessions you can give. It is about both the unionist and the Republican leadership persuading each other that they're serious about this process in the room, talking with each other rather than talking at each other. And I agree with Eamon. This needs the two governments involved, but it also needs international help. We're all too close to it. And we've got to the point now where we cannot take the next steps on our own. We need people who are in a position of leadership to assist with those next steps. But there is no point saying, unionists are absolutely convinced that Republicans are serious. They're not, Leslie. They're not convinced that Republicans are serious about shared space and a shared future. And while Republicans will have serious doubts about Nesbitt and about Robinson and about Hutchinson, that conversation needs to be had and people need to sort this out.
I'm going to have to leave it at that. I think whatever point we cut out, it was going to be an interesting point. So thank you so much. If you want to come up and speak to these guys afterwards,
so
corner them.